From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Earlier this morning, President Trump says he had a 20-minute conversation with Saudi King Salman. The president said the king denied any knowledge of the disappearance of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The president speculated rogue killers could be responsible. How should the president respond to the potential role of Saudi assassins? We'll consider that right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is November 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Welcome, such pleasure to have you with us. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk with writer Celeste Ng about a piece she just wrote about the hostility and she and some of her Asian American women acquaintances have experienced from Asian men over outmarrying. In other words, marrying someone who's not Asian. We'll talk about that because, of course, it's very common for Asian women to marry outside of their own ethnicity. We'll talk about what those relations end up receiving, the way of feedback. But first, we take a look at the dramatic political developments over the past week. So much for us to talk about, including, as you just heard on NPR News, the ongoing concern about the disappearance of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. President Donald Trump today spoke with reporters outside the White House.
Mike Pompeo is leaving literally within an hour or so. He's heading to Saudi Arabia. We are going to leave nothing uncovered. With that being said, the king firmly denied any knowledge of it. He didn't really know. Maybe I don't want to get into his mind, but it sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows? We're going to try getting to the bottom of it very soon. But his was a flat denial.
President Trump speaking this morning to reporters, and as he mentioned, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is en route to Saudi Arabia. But this puts the administration in a difficult position with a longtime ally and one with whom there are major weapons sales agreements. With us, UCLA Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies, Matt Barreto. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as we kick off our weekly political roundup, your thoughts about the difficult spot this puts the Trump administration. What do you think is the best way to handle this?
Well, certainly, I think he's going to need to come out with a very strong response. You saw at the very beginning, he said he didn't have enough information. Now he has talked to the king, who has denied it. And the question will be, as more information comes out, as the Turkish information comes out, if there are recordings, if there's other evidence, he's going to have to very strongly disavow the Saudi government. You already have other Republicans like Marco Rubio, who was very strong when Obama just shook hands with Raul Castro. And Rubio has come out and said he's 100% certain that the Congress will do something. So I think that's really raised the expectations here. As more information comes out, now Trump is in a position where he's going to have to do something, severe punishment, as he said, to the Saudi government in this case.
Also with us, Professor of Politics, Claremont McKenna College, Jack Pitney. Professor, great to have you with us again. How do you think the administration should respond, particularly if there is even more evidence to Saudi governmental involvement?
I agree. There has to be a strong response. Trump's instincts go in the opposite direction. He's totally transactional. The United States does a lot of business with Saudi Arabia, and he doesn't want to do anything to jeopardize that. But in the long run, looking weak here is going to have serious consequences, not only in the Middle East, but for the whole range of foreign policy issues. And that ultimately is not good for the United States. Trump is in a very uncomfortable position. He doesn't want to jeopardize trade, but he doesn't want to look weak either. Something's got to give.
Is there political vulnerability here for the president in how he deals with this, or is this essentially a moral issue?
For the short term, essentially moral. People don't pay that much attention to foreign policy. Very few votes are going to be cast on the basis of the response to Saudi Arabia. However, in the long run, if the president looks weak, if there are more incidents where foreign dictators see that they have a chance to do anything they want, ultimately that's going to be not only bad for the United States, but in the end, politically bad for Trump.
We're talking with Professors Jack Pitney and Matt Barreto of Claremont McKenna and UCLA, respectively. Also last week, a very dramatic series of developments with the stock market. We had the dramatic fall of about 5% in stock prices. The rebound on Friday. Today, stocks are holding pretty steady. But Professor Pitney, I wanted to ask you about this because President Trump came out last week and ridiculed the Fed and interest rate hikes and blaming them for what was going on in the stock market. Your thoughts about this?
Well, most economists think that Trump's comments are loco, not the actions of the Federal Reserve. Again, short term, long term. Short term, it's possible the stock market could continue to rise for a while. But a couple of things in the long term look very bad for our economic future. One is the persistence of trade wars. Trump continues to pursue a protectionist policy. And if we know anything, it's that trade wars kill jobs in the long run. The second thing is the federal debt. Sometime within the next decade, federal debt held by the public is going to top 100% of gross domestic product. We haven't been there since World War II, and that was a spike. This is something that will persist and will have all kinds of bad economic consequences, and there's no sign the president is serious about doing anything about it.
Matt Barreto, I mean, this is the area where the president can tout what's happened during his 2 years in office. The stock market has boomed. The unemployment rate is down into historic levels, and you've got an economy that, you know, seeing wage growth after a significant period of stagnation. So as you look at that aspect here, if things get dicey with the economy, does that potentially, you know, take away the big thing that the president has to tout?
Well, certainly the economy is always one of the top issues that voters evaluate the incumbent party, whether it's the president or the party that's in majority on. And in this case, they're going to want to stick to what's working and what's happening, which is why it's surprising that Trump would come out and criticize the Fed so extensively when the market is going to move up and down and when he has been making lots of appointments to the Fed. So a lot of these folks that are on there are his appointments. They need to stick to the bigger picture. And so reacting on a day-by-day basis of whose fault it is that the market dropped is just ridiculous. And so if they take that broader picture, I think they're going to see that the Fed knows what they're doing. They've been in a long period of market growth, and they're the ones who have been helping control things like inflation and job loss, not necessarily the actions of one particular president or Congress. And so it's better to just sort of get out of the way and let the news on the economy unfold.
All right. We're talking with Professors Matt Barreto and Jack Pitney. It's our weekly Monday roundup of all things political. You can comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You can also join us with your call at 866-893-5722. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley announced last week her resignation effective at the end of this year. It caught seemingly everybody by surprise, except for President Trump. Professor Barreto, your thoughts on what this means for the Trump administration and her potentially bright political future?
Well, yeah, she's someone who is generally respected within bipartisan circles, and I think that UN job is definitely an important one for a resume builder, for a career builder. And so I think a lot of people are asking sort of what's next for Nikki Haley. And what's floating around right now in sort of political circles is that, is Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, is he potentially on a short list to join the Trump cabinet? There's always turnover at the sort of 2-year mark at the midterms. And of course, we know who's at the top of that list is Jeff Sessions. And so is Lindsey Graham going to become the attorney general, perhaps? And does that mean there's an open U.S. Senate seat in South Carolina? Is that what Nikki Haley was thinking? I would keep my eye on that. I wouldn't rule it out as a crazy conspiracy theory. I think there is some thought that Lindsey Graham is buttering up to the Trump administration, and that would leave Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, in a very good position, perhaps, to become a U.S. senator.
Jack Pitney, what do you think about that scenario?
It's her most likely route to the U.S. Senate. Otherwise, Lindsey Graham has indicated that he wants to stay in the Senate a long time. The other senator from South Carolina, Tim Scott, isn't very old. So unless there is a Graham appointment to a Trump cabinet, she might have to wait a long time till there's an open Senate seat. So that would be her best and easiest route to national office.
Well, yeah, and if she is looking at a presidential run, sometime down the road here, first of all, do you think that her standing within the Republican Party, Jack, if she decides 6 years from now she's going to run, would put her in good stead in a Republican primary?
Well, she certainly hasn't done anything to hurt her prospects within the Republican Party. On the one hand, she had a reasonable record as governor of South Carolina, something that you couldn't characterize as extreme. On the other hand, she was very complimentary to President Trump and hasn't antagonized his supporters. The trouble is 6 years is a very long time in politics, and she has very high standing now, but will people remember her in 6 years? That's another question.
We, of course, had the swearing in of Justice Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court last week. He started hearing cases. Jack, I wonder your thoughts about the political ramifications of the deeply divided confirmation process of Kavanaugh. Voters can have short memories, but this was so intense. Do you think there's a lingering effect on the midterms?
There seems to be. A lot of Republicans were saying this was energizing their base because they believed that Kavanaugh was treated very unfairly, and that was a common theme of Trump and his retinue of supporters. But the impact seems to be even greater on the Democratic side. Enthusiasm has increased on both sides, but the increase has been greater on the Democratic side. So we're likely to see higher than average turnout in the midterms, and the increase seems to favor the Democrats at this point. Though one thing we learned 2 years ago is it's important to hedge any prediction about an election.
Well, and Matt, typically when it comes to the Supreme Court, as I understand it, the passion advantage is really to Republicans, that Republican voters pay particular attention to the composition of the court. Do you feel like that shifted with Kavanaugh?
Yeah, I think so. I think Jack is right here that there appears to be a larger enthusiasm or a motivating issue on the Democratic side. There were multiple new polls out this week showing Kavanaugh was especially unpopular with women. And this does appear to have some sort of spillover effect on congressional elections, and especially in cases where the candidates have strongly defended Kavanaugh. So you have a lot of people viewing Kavanaugh unpopularly, viewing that the investigation didn't go far enough. And now you have different candidates for Congress and especially Senate who maybe took a very strong stance defending him. And I think that voters are going to be evaluating that. They're going to be remembering that, especially as some of those taglines are put into campaign ads. And you see the senator or the House member continuing to endorse or defend Kavanaugh. It could be very effective because the polls that have come out have shown that voters believe that there should have been more. It should have been a longer process. And I don't think the issue is going to go away, unlike what happened with Clarence Thomas decades ago. I think this is an issue that may resurface in 2019 when there's a new Congress.
Really?
I wouldn't be surprised if some in the House want to further the investigation, perhaps look at some of these statements that Mr. Kavanaugh has made under oath and determine whether or not they were truthful or not, or if there was anything to the allegation. So I wouldn't be surprised if this issue continues to have some legs even after the election, because it was something that people were so passionate about, especially this idea that it could be settled in 1 week. all of these allegations. So I'm going to continue following this, and I think it may have a little bit more legs. Hmm.
It's interesting because I can't cite the source. Unfortunately, I don't recall where I saw this, but among independent voters, it showed that there was less sympathy toward Democrats in the Senate and how they handled the confirmation process than Republicans, more criticism of Democrats. But and of course, there may not be enough independents to really make a difference. But do you think there's any cause for concern among Democrats there, Matt Barreto?
Well, there certainly is to the first point that I don't think it's with independents. I think there is a subgroup of conservative men, the ones that President Trump was really channeling when he said this is a very hard time and that you're getting these false allegations. I think there are people who might relate to that and see that Kavanaugh, or they feel that Kavanaugh was wrongly accused. But that's a subset, because in the polls that we've seen, even independent and conservative-leaning women say that they were unhappy with how the process played out and that this is not who their choice would be for a conservative justice. And so I think that there's a bigger downside, and especially among women who may have been open to a Republican vote, this may have pushed them farther away from that.
All right. Your thoughts on that, Jack, before we break?
Important difference between the House and the Senate. There are some states in which this issue may have helped the Republicans in North Dakota. Heidi Heitkamp, who came out against Kavanaugh, is running behind. Republicans may well pick up that seat. Conversely, in the House, it does seem to be energizing Democrats and adding to what seems very likely to be a Democratic majority.
All right. We're talking with Professor of Politics Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College, Matt Barreto, Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies at UCLA. He's also the co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. We'll continue with the latest in politics. Also look at where national Republicans are choosing to put their money into which congressional races. A couple of very high-profile ones in Southern California are not getting that degree of national backing that had been expected. We'll talk about that, and also a new CNN poll looking at potential Democratic nominees in 2020. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Every Monday, we talk politics and we bring you terrific matchups of political analysts. Today, it's Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College and Matt Barreto of UCLA weighing in on the top political news. Of course, ground zero in the big fight for control of the House of Representatives right here in Southern California, where you've got a handful of very high-profile races where districts that have historically been Republican could flip Democratic. This includes the district where Dana Rohrabacher has represented Newport Beach, Huntington Beach, and surrounding communities. He's locked in a very tough fight. Also, Mimi Walters in an adjacent district of Irvine and surrounding communities. And now the question of where the national Republican dollars are going to go into these most contested races. Jack, one of the things that we see is that some of these races that have been designated don't include some of these high-profile Southern California ones. Is that largely a factor just of the cost to advertise here, or do you think Republicans are thinking that these districts may be lost?
Well, it's triage. Yes, it's expensive to advertise here, but if you watch the morning news, you'll notice several candidates are, in fact, advertising on broadcast television, regardless of the extreme expense. Story today, extremely significant, that Dana Rohrabacher, incumbent, has been cut off by the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is a leading Republican super PAC. That's an indication that they don't have a great deal of confidence in his survival chances and are instead channeling their resources to other districts and other states where they think they have a chance of protecting an incumbent and shoring up their dwindling majority.
So you think that they're
that their fear is perhaps this could be close to a clean sweep for Democrats in California?
I think they're pretty much resigned to losing several seats. Rohrabacher is in trouble. Diane Harkey, a candidate to succeed Daryl Issa, looks like she's going to lose. Mimi Walters, another candidate, likely to go down. There are seats in California that Republicans think they can hold on to in the race to succeed Ed Royce. Young Kim is a very strong candidate, good record of in elected office, well respected in Sacramento. She might be able to hold on to that seat for the Republicans, but overall, they're going to lose a lot of ground.
Well, and are you shocked to be looking at South Orange County as a place where Democratic House members would reside?
Not too shocking. I spent about a decade living in Orange County, and during that time I witnessed the demographic and political change in the county. Orange County is now majority-minority. And also you have a lot of upper-income professionals who are part of a group that are leaning increasingly Democratic. And Hillary Clinton carried Orange County in 2016. So that's a datum that gave a lot of hope to Democrats, and they're probably going to make some serious inroads this fall.
Matt Barreto, JSK, writes on the page, the Dems have much more money to spend. Yeah, that's one of the things that was released last week, is looking at the tremendous amount of fundraising that Democrats have done around the congressional election. This has to be a great concern to the GOP.
Yeah, I think so. I'm sorry.
Were you going to say something, Jack? Go ahead.
No,
Matt, go ahead. Thanks.
I'm sorry about that, Jack. I think that this is a concern for the Republicans, especially in expensive markets. So Los Angeles is an expensive market, and the Democrats do have a fundraising advantage here. And as a result, they're able to not just advertise on television, but put those dollars into door-to-door canvassing, into outreach, into mailers, into more local events. And so I do think you're going to see that here in California, as well as some other places, the suburbs of Houston, which are also an expensive media market, the suburbs of Dallas, which are an expensive media market. Those are places where these suburban districts are shifting, as Jack was just discussing. They're getting more demographically and politically diverse, and the Democrats have a fundraising advantage this year because of that enthusiasm that they started on in January of 2017, really starting this anti-Trump fundraising. And that appears to be playing itself out now, not just in California, but as I said, in other suburban markets around the country, where you see Republicans thinking about pulling out, not putting their PAC money into those ads.
Yesterday, CNN put out a poll of the likely presidential candidates 2 years from now. And of those polled, it was pretty much in the middle as to whether Americans think President Trump will win re-election in 2020. Obviously, we've got a long ways to go. But asking likely Democratic voters and Democratic-leaning voters who they would support if the election is today, former VP Joe Biden ended up with a third of the support in the field, 33%. Bernie Sanders trailed significantly at 13%. Then it was California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Senator at 8%, Cory Booker down at 5%, John Kerry at 5%, Michael Bloomberg, former New York City mayor at 4%, and then it drops down from there, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti at 2%. Jack, I'm curious your thoughts about this. To me, this seems like it's largely about name recognition at this point. You know, we pay a lot of attention to this. Probably for most Democratic Party voters, they're not even familiar with a good chunk of the names on this list.
That's right. And if you look at past elections, these numbers aren't always very predictive. Now, I have to confess a certain interest in this because one of the names on the poll is Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who was my student back in the 80s. Now, Governor Bullock is at less than 1%. And the way I like to think of that is he has tremendous upside potential.
He won't go down. That's funny. But your thoughts about, you know, Joe Biden, and do you think he is realistically the strongest Democratic candidate?
He definitely has strengths. Number one, universal name recognition. Number two, potential to unify different wings of the Democratic Party. The trouble is, it's Joe Biden. If you look at his past campaigns, he's prone to make mistakes. And 1988 campaign, he had to withdraw. Didn't do well in the 2008 campaign when he was running for president. So if I were running the Democrats, I'd leave the door open to a variety of other candidates as well.
Well, and you wonder if gaffes mean so much now with President Trump and the things that he says, if Joe Biden would even be noticed for some of the things that he said that raised eyebrows in the past. Yeah. Matt Barreto, your thoughts about this field?
I think it is largely reflective of name recognition. And so what I would do is interpret that through how much the voters know about these folks. So for someone like Bernie Sanders, he should have universal name recognition after an extremely strong primary challenge in 2016. So for him to be considerably behind Biden, that's not a great sign. Now, he hasn't announced he's not necessarily running. But if that contingency was still as fervent for him, we would have seen him higher. On the other hand, someone like Senator Harris from here in California, she's newer on the scene. And so that third position in this poll might actually be a strong point. She might be exceeding expectations of where she would be nationally, already gaining this sort of profile. So it's not necessarily to say that Joe Biden is the front runner, but really, where do they stand in comparison to how much name recognition they have and where they should stand? And I have to agree with what Jack said there at the end, that I think Biden is not necessarily the candidate for the Democrats in 2020, even though he has many likable characteristics and is very appealing in a number of ways. He's been on the stage, and his job now is sort of as the elder statesman, in the same way as a John Kerry, to sort of support and endorse the candidates. But it's really time for someone newer to emerge, someone to come onto the scene with fresh ideas. And I think that's what you're hearing in most of the focus groups and polls on the Democratic side.
The challenge is, you know, all those younger folks are quite to the left. And so the question is, does the party end up potentially shooting itself in the foot if it nominates someone who's highly progressive and can't play in middle America?
Yeah, that's been the challenge that the Democrats are grappling with right now. And I think so far they've had a combination of both progressive candidates emerge and the ones who are more moderate or traditional or mainstream. And in this 2018 cycle, when you're looking at Senate and House, and they appear to be working together. They appear to all be rowing in the same direction at this point. And that's good news. That means there's something for everybody on the Democratic side. The question will be, when it comes to presidential politics, if they repeat the fights and the mistakes of 2016 and that they weren't able to come together as cohesively, that will certainly be a mistake. And so sometimes you can learn from those past episodes and say, going forward, we need to be more united, more cohesive. And I think there's more energy and excitement behind some of these newer voices and newer faces, which are a little bit more to the left of center.
And by the way, we had Elizabeth Warren coming out with a DNA analysis over the weekend. This in response to the ridicule that she's faced from President Trump, who's referred to as Pocahontas, over her claims that she has American Indian ancestry. But I wonder if it really helps her, because it could be as far as 8 to 10 generations back, and how helpful that's really, really going to be to sort of counter the criticism that she's overstating that in her background, Jack.
Yeah, I think this is not an issue that's likely to change votes one way or the other. If you like Elizabeth Warren, you've already decided. And if you dislike her, you've already decided. But the more significant Elizabeth Warren story out of recent days is that she has a so-called war room underway, a serious organization presumably preparing for a race for president in 2020. And this is a person that we know has a lot of support among Democratic activists. So this is somebody worth watching. The back and forth between her and Trump is going to continue.
I also want to call attention to a Los Angeles Times op-ed written by Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College, in which he urges Democrats, if they take the House of Representatives, not to repeat what Newt Gingrich did in the middle of the Clinton presidency. Real quickly, your thoughts on why that would be a mistake, Jack?
Number one, Gingrich got into deep ethics trouble. That would be a sure route to Democrat self-immolation. But also, on substance, the Republicans did a lot of investigation. They botched the job. They ended up looking very foolish. It's important to do investigations, but you have to do them right. You have to do them on the substance and hire seasoned professionals to carry them out.
Gentlemen, want to thank you both for being with us. That's Claremont McKenna College's Jack Pitney. Also from UCLA, Professor Matt Barreto joining us on Air Talk. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, the criticism that some Asian American women get for their relationships with non-Asian American guys. We'll come back with more on that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. I was surprised reading an essay last week by novelist Celeste Ng in which she described the criticism that she and some other Asian American women have received from Asian American men over relationships or marriages with non-Asian American men. Whenever we've talked about out marriage, as it's called on Air Talk, we learned that the highest rate of out marriage is Asian American women. Latinas come in second, and that it's so common in the culture that it kind of surprised me to find out that there are in some cases a backlash. The question is how much of it is there? Is this trolling on social media? You know, a small number of people that are making a lot of noise about this, and with in some cases insults and threats. Or is this a deeper culture phenomenon of Asian American men truly upset about Asian American women having relationships with or marrying outside of their groups? I'd like to hear from you if you're an Asian American woman, you're in a relationship or married to a non-Asian American. What's the response been? Have you had any negative feedback to that? We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joining me is Professor of Urban Planning and Asian American Studies at UCLA, Karen Umemoto. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So after reading this, were you surprised, or is this something you've heard much about, this sort of criticism?
The criticism or the issue of...
The criticism from Asian American men, is this something that you've heard about?
Oh, yeah, I think it's been an issue for decades. During the Asian American movement of the 60s, this was an issue, and I think Celeste Ng's article just calls our attention to the, you know, kind of the new heights of harassment, given the expanse of social media, I think, which brings a new dimension to the problem of hate speech.
I guess what surprised me is it's so common. There's just so much out marriage among Asian American women. I would have thought that after all these years of there being so much of it, that Asian American men would kind of be used to that. But is part of this driven by the fact that there are social media platforms for men who are unhappy about this to raise these issues?
Yeah, I think so. But I also don't want to magnify it bigger than it is. I don't think we know how much of that sentiment exists. I don't think that we have ways of measuring it. So I think it's a longstanding issue, this controversy over whether or not, you know, Asians should marry Asians or not. And I think it's important for us to put it in a broader social and historical context, because I think it's very dangerous the way that people are being attacked and harassed, and that takes away from addressing some of the, you know, more structural historic sources of the problem.
Well, and you call it a problem. Is this a problem that people are out marrying?
No, I don't call it. I don't mean that. That's a problem.
Okay.
Or the controversy.
Oh, the like threats and things like that. Yes, I see what you're saying. And one of the things that Celeste Ng in her piece last week brings up that this seems to tie into sort of stereotypical attitudes about Asian American men. And I wonder if you can speak to that and how that might play into this.
Yeah, and I think that does get to some of the historical roots of the controversy, where Asian American men have throughout American history been emasculated in various ways. I think it's partly a result of the imagery produced by mass media, and there are winners and losers in that imagery. I think from the early times of Asian American history, where Chinese railroad workers and others were promoted in predatory ways during the Yellow Peril of the 1880s, to the nerdy Asian male stereotype of more recent days, these are ways that Asian men have wrongly been emasculated that has direct consequences on social behavior and to their detriment. And so I think there are ways to understand and explain the source of frustration and anger. But as I said, I think it's also highly dangerous to and misdirected to attack and harass individuals for their personal choices.
I'd love to hear again, if you are an Asian American woman or man, I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts about this and what you've seen if you're involved in a relationship with a non-Asian American. What sort of responses have you gotten from family, from friends? Has there been hostility because you're not having a relationship or a marriage with someone from your same ethnicity? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley writes on the page, being Asian myself, I've seen an entitlement mentality in the Asian community, especially among older Asians. Another point is in Asian cultures, the firstborn male has a lot of pressure to continue the family line, ideally with someone of similar or better, however that's defined, lot in life. Ideally, that other person is of the same tribe, in quotes. A Cantonese man would not necessarily be acceptable to a Taiwanese woman, for example. On top of that, because of culture, Asian men can be trapped in the old world culture, perhaps can't make the transition to the modern global culture as easily as the women. That's Bill in the San Gabriel Valley weighing in. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Sparky tweets at Air Talk, my Japanese wife gets dirty looks from Asian men. It happened before social media. Brandon in Glacelle Park says, my mother is Chinese, my father's Polish. Often in Western culture, Asian men are desexualized. As a gay, half-Asian man, Brandon writes, I've experienced this. Both my mother's siblings married Caucasian people. I see this with a lot of my family. Air Talk page again, kpecc.org or 866-893-KPECC. Professor Umamoto, your thoughts about these comments?
I think the first about kind of there is an intergenerational difference between the older generations and the younger generations in terms of how acceptable it is to marry outside of your particular ethnicity. And depending on what generation in the United States you are, there may be more or less pressure to marry within your ethnic group. I think that's a tension that many families go through, and that's kind of a negotiated, you know, issue that I think the listener was wise to point out. I think the issue of desexualized men, it still is a problem today, and I'm very sympathetic and empathetic towards that. I think there are very few Asian men in positions of power within the corporate world. There's still a very thick glass ceiling within that world, and there are still such limited depictions of and roles of Asian American men in popular media. So I think that that still remains a problem today that really needs to be addressed in a bigger platform.
And will undoubtedly change with time. I would guess we're going to see a lot more Patrick Soon-Shiong and people who are very high-profile Asian American leaders, just given the large number of highly educated Asian American men and women who live, particularly here in California. It's just such a big part of our demographic. Melissa in Palm Desert says, I'm a white woman married to an Asian man. I feel like we've faced a lot of issues, especially when we lived in the South. We wouldn't be shown certain houses. We would get strange treatment in restaurants. We also lived in Hawaii, and I felt backlash from Asian women there. That's Melissa in Palm Desert. She says she's white and married to an Asian American man. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about this. Novelist Celeste Ng wrote an essay for the publication The Cut, in which she described the kinds of harassment that she and others have received as a result of being married to or in relationships with non-Asian American men. 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about Out Marriage, an essay by novelist Celeste Ng, in which she describes online and social media harassment that she and other women who've married outside of their ethnicity have received as a result of it. Pretty extreme stuff. I suppose, as shocking as it is, it's also less shocking than it used to be, because we see so much terrible stuff that people are willing to put in writing on social media. But nonetheless, this raises, the very serious question of how much sorts of, negative feedback do Asian American women receive if they date or marry outside of their ethnicity. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Asian American women, to my understanding, are the group that outmarries the most, followed by Latinas as the next largest group that outmarries. And it's interesting because both Latino men, Latinas, have higher rates of outmarriage, certainly than whites do, or than, say, African Americans do. And it's interesting, being married to a Latina myself, the only time I ever, in our 25 years of marriage, had any sort of a negative encounter over being married to a Latina was in Mexico, of all things. Only sort of hostile interaction with a man who was upset about me being there with my wife. But never anything here in Southern California. It's just so common. And I was a little surprised to see that for Asian American women, that there is this sort of negative feedback, given how common it is to see mixed couples here in Southern California. Just everyday fact of our life. 866. You see it walking around everywhere. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with Karen Umamoto, professor of urban planning and Asian American studies at UCLA, where she heads the Asian American Studies Center. Again, I'd like to hear from you if you are Asian American, a woman or man, your thoughts on this. Ronnie, where are you calling us from?
From Placentia.
All right, Placentia. Ronnie, go right ahead. Your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I personally don't have a problem with it. I'm an Asian American male. I don't have problems with Asian females outmarrying, as long as they don't try to hold it over other Asian Americans who have stayed within the race, so to speak. Thinking that they have advanced their place in their social status.
Yeah, and do you feel like that sometimes is the case, that there are people who outmarry or out have relationships who act as though somehow they're better because of that?
Sometimes I do. I think it a lot of it is shown by whom they choose to socialize with. And so if they totally rebuke where they come from and not hang out with Asians anymore and just totally try to act white or you know, whatever they married into, I think it's all about remembering where you come from and, you know, sticking to your roots or just remembering where you come from.
Yeah.
We're all evolving, and as long as they, you know, try to stay true to themselves.
Now, Ronnie, have you had relationships with non-Asian women?
You know, growing up, that's all I dated is, you know, non-Asian women, and a lot of that had to do with me trying to fit in. And I'm married to a Korean woman, and I think it's just part of my growing up, and that's just my story. I'm not trying to say one way is right or wrong, but I did experience that as an Asian American growing up here in the U.S., just trying to fit in.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And hopefully you chose your wife based on who she is as a person, her ethnicity secondary to that. But Ronnie, I appreciate it very much. Thank you for sharing your experience. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Rondo writing on the page says the reason why Asian men are forming a backlash is because many Asian American women just decided to not date Asian men based on the fact that they are Asian without considering the individual personality at all. Professor Umemoto, do you think that's very common, that Asian American women just dismiss the idea that they will have romantic relationships with Asian men?
I mean, I think there are some, but again, these things are not really quantifiable. I don't know that there's been any studies about that, so I don't want to, you know, pump it up higher than that might be the case. But I think one of the things that Ronnie spoke to was the self-hatred that many people of color in this country do face because of the legacies and the current manifestations of white supremacist attitudes and images and kind of privileges that still remain. So those things are going to naturally affect, you know, who we...
Well, he didn't say he hated himself. He just said he wanted to fit in. He felt he'd fit in more. So that doesn't necessarily mean that he felt hostile to his culture.
Sure. I'm not saying Ronnie feels self-hate, but I'm just saying he raises the issue of self-hatred. And I think there is that. And I don't know that we acknowledge that enough and create safe spaces to have conversations about that. I appreciate his frankness in some of the, you know, questioning that he...
Yeah. John in Santa Ana. John, I've got about 45 seconds. Please share your perception. I understand you're Korean-American.
Yes, I am. I grew up on the East Coast in a small community where, you know, the Korean community was really tight. And then as time gets... As the population increased, the Korean American population, you see more intermarrying, and you just become more open to it. And then we move out here to California, and you see so many mixed couples. Of course, just like your experience, Larry, you know, you don't really, it doesn't faze you at all.
Yeah, you don't even think about it. It's so common.
Exactly.
John, I appreciate that. Talking about the regional differences, I think it's a really important point you raise. Morgan in Pasadena says, I'm Asian American. I think the traditional Chinese family treats women in a secondary position, so women feel alienated by that, and they're looking for marriage outside where they don't feel that stigma. That's Morgan, who says he's Asian American, sharing his opinion about that. My thanks to UCLA Director of the Asian American Studies Center, Karen Umemoto. She's also Professor of Urban Planning and Asian American Studies. I'd welcome your comments, particularly if you are Asian American. I'm interested in your thoughts, your response to novelist Celeste Ng's essay, When Asian American Asian Women Are Harassed for Marrying Non-Asian Men.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a Master's in Clinical Psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The gifted writer Susan Orlean joins me later this hour. Remember her from The Orchid Thief, the bestseller. She's such a great writer. Her new book, The Library Book, and the library that she tells the story of is our great Central Library downtown Los Angeles, which suffered a catastrophic fire in 1986. I was actually across the street as that fire was being fought. I was near the top of the old First Interstate Bank Tower looking down on that. And the place I'd gone as just a little boy to that library had such fond memories of it. I just remember what a tough day that was, seeing all the smoke pouring out. But, of course, the library came back better than ever. And we'll hear that story from Susan Orlean coming up later this hour. But first, we begin with the potential that power could be shut off by Southern California Edison to parts of Southern California as a preventive measure because of high winds. With me, KPCC reporter to start us on it, Sharon McNary. Sharon, first of all, there was the threat over the weekend PG&E was going to do this in Northern California. What's going on with this?
Well, we know that high winds can bring down power lines and that can start fires. And we also know that during fires, power lines can spread fires. Power lines and power equipment are one of the biggest causes of fires in the state. So last night and this morning, PG&E up in Northern California, where they had those terrible fires last year that killed so many people, they've actually turned off the power to about 60,000 people. In fact, in the Calistoga School District, they don't have power, so they're not having school today.
Yeah. My dad lives over the hill from Calistoga.
Oh,
I was talking to him on the phone, and the phone just went dead.
Well, it probably blew out of his hands.
Yeah.
Such strong winds. So Southern California Edison is putting people on notice that they're preparing for the possibility of this. We don't know that they've done it yet, even though there's many individuals that are out of power.
Well, joining us from Southern California Edison, spokeswoman Melissa Subotin, thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Subotin. We've had Santa Ana winds for many years here. Why now the potential to shut down these transmission lines?
And just as a point of clarification, I'm actually a spokesperson for PG&E.
Oh, PG&E. My apologies. All right.
That's okay. You know, when we look at a number of different factors that contribute to fire risks, we take into consideration red flag warning issued by the National Weather Service, low humidity levels, generally 20% or below, sustained winds above approximately 25 miles an hour and gusts around more than 45 miles an hour, and site-specific conditions such as temperature and terrain. And then we assess the fuel on the ground. We have crews that are conducting real-time observations. And when we look at that holistically, we determine if there's a potential threat for a fire. And if so, we take the necessary steps too.
Have you ever done this before, though? Have you ever prophylactically cut the power on these major transmission lines to avoid the risk of fire?
Excuse me. No, this is the first time.
Oh, that's right. I'll give you a moment, because that's all right. If you want to take a sip of water or something, I'll come back to you. Melissa Subotin of Pacific Gas and Electric PG&E in Northern California. So she's saying this is the first time they've done that. My initial thought when I heard about this over the weekend, Sharon, is, oh, so their response, because they've been held liable financially in part for like the devastating Santa Rosa, Napa Valley, is like, okay, fine, you're going to hold us responsible for this and this level of maintenance that
We can't have a power line down to start a fire. We'll just cut the power on it.
Well, it's not a terrible idea. Since 2012, the PUC has allowed like San Diego Gas and Electric to do it. And then last November, after the big fires in Northern California, they did extend that permission statewide to the big utilities.
All right. I think we got you back, Melissa. So this is the first time that you've done it, and you think this is going to be a standard operating procedure when you get these strong winds?
You know, it's certainly something that we're taking into consideration as we look at the new normal around climate change, as we have increased risk of fire across our service territory, the absolute highest priority is the safety of our customers and the communities we serve. And if we determine that to protect their safety, we need to proactively turn off their power as part of our public safety power shutoff, we will take the steps to do so, as we did this weekend.
Of course, there are safety concerns with cutting the power because in some cases, you know, electricity flowing can be a life and death issue for medical equipment, other things like that. If you were to be fully indemnified against any harm caused by your lines going down in high wind, would you still cut the power?
You know, we are constantly assessing and evolving how we operate our electric infrastructure, given the impact of climate change. We are also making operational changes to the practices in order to improve safety and reliability. You know, we're taking into consideration the new normal and the increased threat of wildfire across the state of California. You know, for PG&E, our service territory is 70,000 square miles. We have very diverse geography and topography. And when you look at the California Public Utilities Commission and CAL FIRE's fire threat assessments, we have a number of customers who are in the highest fire threat areas. So, you know, when we have 24-hour monitoring here at PG&E around the weather, and we are constantly assessing whether or not there's an increased threat for wildfires. And we saw the conditions line up this weekend: low humidity, high wind gusts. We had wind gusts in some areas exceeding over 80 miles an hour, and in some areas 90 miles an hour in the Sierras. So, you know, we determined that in order to protect the safety of our customers, we had to move forward with our public safety power shutoff.
I want to thank you for being with us, Melissa Subotin of Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, that's cut off some of the power in Northern California because of those high winds. They don't call them Santa Anas up there. Tony writes on the page, we call them Diablo winds because of Mount Diablo. That makes sense. Joaquin in South L.A. writes on the page, PG&E paid $2.5 billion as a result of the fires last year and faces risk of more liability. They can't escape liability and they can't turn off the power. What do you expect them to do? And I'd like to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. So if this is going to be the new normal, what about indemnifying the power companies against damage that come? And as long as they show they're maintaining their lines, they're not going to be perfect, obviously. But what about indemnifying power companies so that electricity can continue? Do you think that that makes sense? It's worth the potential risk to keep the power flowing or not? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. Also with us from Consumer Watchdog, the president, Jamie Court. Jamie, thank you for joining us again. What do you think about potentially indemnifying the power companies against damages from the fires?
Well, I think, you know what I think, Larry?
I know your answer. I just asked it as a rhetorical device.
The fact that you're asking this question is exactly what the utilities wanted.
Of course.
They have, for the first time, put a protocol in without asking the PUC for the specifics of whether it's right, without asking CAL FIRE whether it's needed, to threaten blackouts when there's high winds. I mean, it's like when we have too many flu epidemics, do we close the schools? That's what they're saying until they get what they want. We just gave the utilities a bailout letting them to pass on to ratepayers in the legislature all the costs of fires for the last year. We just did that. Okay, we don't even know the cost. It's going to be tens of billions of dollars, but we don't know exactly. They have the right to do that right now. they didn't get as much as they wanted. And I believe this is kind of how they operate. The second thing is they also got hundreds of millions of dollars to improve their equipment. And it, and let's be clear, what is the cause of fires is usually vegetation management or equipment that hasn't been updated. They've got the money to do that. They were unhappy they didn't get a bigger bailout. They put in a protocol that now I believe should be taken a look at by Cal Fire, as well as hearings should be held by the PUC. Because as you say, blackouts cause more damage. But I do believe this is a form of what we've seen before in California, blackout blackmail.
All right. But the other side from their perspective is, and you mentioned schools. You know, schools don't get sued for the flu. In this case, they're the ones who are financially liable, right? So
they aren't for the last year based on a legislation that just came out of the legislature that literally gave them the right to issue bonds to cover their losses in the past, not the future. They wanted to be able to do that in the future. But the reason they're liable is twofold. One is because their equipment hasn't been updated, because they haven't trimmed the trees around the lines, and they can pass those costs on. It's their own negligence. The second reason is when they put the equipment in your backyard using eminent domain, they have the responsibility legally, because they've condemned your backyard, to take it over to maintain that equipment. This debate played out in the legislature. It came down in the middle, Larry, that they were allowed to pass on their costs in the past. They were allowed to get money
okay.
for their equipment and clear the brush in the future. But what they're trying to do is reopen that debate right now to get even more from. And what they do is this. They socialize the risks of these fires, and they privatize it again. They've made billions of dollars. They're a regulated monopoly. PG&E is a stock company. Edison is a stock company. The investors have made a lot of money. But when there's risks now, they're doing something very extreme at the inconvenience of communities because they didn't
okay.
spare the shareholders.
All right, let me bring back Melissa Subodin of PG&E. You want to respond? Oh, I'm sorry. I had a message that she was back with us, but apparently not. All right. Let me bring Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure correspondent, back. So, Sharon, what do you think is going to be the upshot of this? Because if we're going to have, every fall power being shut off in the state, big
deal.
Well,
the bill that Jamie Court's talking about was SB 901, and it included a whole range of things that it's now requiring the utilities to do to reduce the risk that their power equipment is going to cause fires. And I think tomorrow, if they're still on, if it's not too windy, I'm going to go out and see some of this equipment installed. Things like insulating the wires so you don't have bare naked wires, insulating the transformers. You know, the fire in Murrieta last December, that burned 300 homes, that was only recently decided by Cal Fire that it was a Southern California Edison responsibility. So Cal Edison employees found some remains of a bird's nest at the bottom of the power pole, and they think a bird's nest that was invisible to the eye from the ground, caused the line to arc over and caused the fire. And we have seen Southern California Edison shut off power to communities preemptively last December in Idlewild. That community was shut down for a couple of days, no power at all, to keep it, to keep the lines from starting a fire. So I think we're going to see more of that. But Southern California Edison has put in a request to the PUC to spend $542 million upgrading its whole system. And then there's another thing. Why not just put the lines underground? It's extremely expensive.
Oh, yeah.
But in Laguna Beach, remember where it burned like 24 years ago? The citizens of Laguna Beach are going to vote on November 6th to tax themselves one extra cent in sales tax to pay the cost of undergrounding the utility lines that run on their main evacuation road out of there. I think it's Laguna
Beach.
I hope
they have more success than Pasadena, which has been collecting money to underground their utilities for years. And, about every 20 years they do, a few blocks.
Oh, my God. Well, it's very expensive. And it's also
pathetic.
Harder to maintain.
Yeah. All right. Sharon McNary's with us, KPCC infrastructure correspondent Jamie Court of Consumer Watchdog, joining us. Lynette in West L.A. says it's outrageous to shut down power. This is going to make people look at all kinds of alternatives like solar. Of course, the problem with solar is if you need power at night and you're not getting it off your transmission line, you're going to be in a jam there because most people don't have the ability to restore that. JSK says there's a lot of opposition to vegetation management. Now, is that really, I guess this is about, you know, cutting back to avoid fire and whether that might affect these transmission lines, Sharon.
Yeah, and I think SB 901 did give the big utilities a little bit more leeway in cutting vegetation where they need to. I mean, the problem is, you know, it can look like a butcher came through and just clear cut. You know, can you go farther out than just what's going to fall on your power lines? You know, go out 100 feet. It gets very controversial when it's your lovely forest that's being buzzsawed through to keep the power lines clear.
All right. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Jamie, I'm sorry we're out of time. That's Jamie Cord of Consumer Watchdog. Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure reporter. Coming up, an extraordinary scandal in the world of sommeliers. That's right. This very high level of master sommelier. Apparently, a number of individuals were alleged to have cheated on the test, which designates, and a lot of money, a lot of income is at stake. We'll talk about how this could have possibly happened back in 1 minute. A few years ago, there's a terrific documentary that came out called Somm, and it was about the whole process of people going through certification to be master sommeliers. And it is extraordinarily difficult to reach that level. The blind tasting and what you have to be able to identify in the wines requires extraordinary levels of education and a highly refined palate. So I was shocked to see a story over the weekend that this whole process of certifying master sommeliers has been turned upside down with an allegation of cheating on that certification exam. With us, the director of that documentary, Somm, which came out a few years ago and has now actually spawned two sequels to it, Jason Wise. Jason, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thanks, Larry. It's always an honor.
I appreciate it. He's in New York City, by the way, for the premiere of Somm 3. Who knew this was going to be a series of films? But Jason, I understand you know people that are centrally involved in this. This kind of rocked your world.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a member of the court, nor am I a sommelier. I'm just a filmmaker who has literally been next to these people for 8 or 9 years, completely and totally, you know, like brothers and sisters of mine. Yeah, I know them all. That's the, I guess, the fortunate and unfortunate part. This did turn my life upside down in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and so you know the individual who's alleged to have leaked this information so that people could cheat on the test?
Yeah, I do. I do. And his name has sort of been outed by people who have figured out what it is. He was in our first film, not a main character, but in it, and, you know, he's a, and it's going to sound weird, but he's a wonderful guy, a guy who's worked his butt off to get where he was, and it's kind of it's a big shocker.
Has he admitted he did this?
Not publicly that I know of, no.
All right. And
I don't blame him. I mean, the court itself is, you know, I think secretive is the wrong word, but they try to keep things, you know, inside to some extent. So I'm not surprised that you haven't heard.
Yeah, I was not surprised given, you know, you've got people who failed the test multiple times. So much potential income is riding on this. They've spent huge amounts of money preparing for the test and countless hours in preparation for this designation of Master Sommelier, who's a wine expert. I guess what shocked me is that anyone involved in the testing process would leak the information to others, because it would seem that if you've already passed, if you've already, your livelihood has benefited from this, why would you risk that?
No, that's the most shocking thing. I mean, if you look at any really important examination, the bar exam, you know, West Point, the doping committee and the Olympics, I mean, they're all going to have leaks and problems. I think it's part of a growing process of a really important organization that tests. But it's how they deal with it. My experience with the guys and the women and men who are master sommeliers is it was so hard for them. I've seen them be even harder on the people that they're personally training that they want to pass. just because they want them to earn it. So this is it's mind-blowingly shocking. And we're only talking about the tasting portion that I know of that was affected by this. So it was only one part, which I think might be the hardest part for a lot of people, but it wasn't all the parts of the exam.
All right. And how many people appear to have been caught up in this?
That is really unclear outside of the person that kind of leaked some of the wines, I guess, to candidates. I don't know, but I can tell you some of the people that did pass. Now, normally there's like two or one or maybe five people who become masters each year, maybe. There were 20-something this time. So it raised a lot of red flags on how that's possible. And by the way, some of these people have been taking these exams since I first started filming 9 years ago.
I think the San Diego guy who was caught up in this had failed 5 times.
Yeah, and he's such a great guy. I mean, he is such a good guy. And I mean, it's a very, very, very tricky thing. And I mean, I highly, highly doubt every one of these candidates or even a great majority of them cheated. I think the court is dealing with such a difficult situation because how can they know who told others? And I think, God, they took action and just swiped the results off for everybody. And this is an organization that I have seen nothing but, just the highest level of integrity from. And I have, like I said, I'm not a member of them. I have no reason to say that outside of they were so secretive with me and so deeply protective of their process. So.
Yeah, well, in the film, I've seen the first one that you did some. I mean, it shows how meticulous this whole testing process is. How many master sommeliers are there in the world today?
I don't know exactly. I want to say somewhere around 250, 260.
So it's a very, very small group of the most elite experts on wine. And as your film detailed, once someone has reached this designation, it opens up a very lucrative world in the hospitality industry.
Hugely. I mean, their salaries often rise quite a bit. They can walk into different aspects of wine making, wine selling. I mean, their salaries go up two or three times often because the world, it's not that their work gets any easier. I think their work and jobs get even harder, but they can certainly make more money. No question.
And do you think this is going to in any way damage the level of master sommelier, the perception in the wine connoisseur's mind?
No, I don't. I think, to be honest, the court took a really swift and, I would say, from the candidate's perspective that passed and had taken away, brutal action. But they took an action. And like I said, I think this is a growing process for really important, any important examining board you're going to have. It's run by humans. Humans have weaknesses. And I think it's how you deal with that when it comes. I can tell you right now, I don't think it's going to happen again.
And are these individuals who are alleged to have been given the answers, are they going to be able to retest or are they done? No chance to be a master sommelier?
So the court released an official statement saying that, no, they're going to let everybody, even the ones who failed this exam, retake it. Everybody. And that's based on their exact words from their
report. Okay.
And, I mean, I think, you know, but there's always kind of an asterisk now along this thing because, unfortunately, I think most of these people, you take it 9 times and you pass once, you might fail again 9 times. So my heart really goes out to these people that have to retake it who passed honestly because I'm not kidding. It is one of the hardest tests our weird species has ever created.
Jason Wise, I'm amazed anyone can possibly pass it having seen you document it. Jason Wise, thank you so much. We'll also look forward to Psalm 3, your third film in the series, when it opens in Los Angeles. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Larry, so much.
Appreciate it. Jason Wise, Psalm Into the Bottle, and Psalm 3, the documentary series of this very fascinating process of creating master sommeliers. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back in 1 minute with the great writer Susan Orlean. Her new book, The Library Book, which gives us tremendous insight into the history of our own Los Angeles Central Library. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. My son had enjoyed being John Malkovich so much. I said, well, you've got to see Adaptation because it's unlike any other movie you've ever seen. And so I hadn't seen it actually since its theatrical release and enjoyed it yet again. The brilliant Charlie Kaufman and with the way that that film totally changes as a critique of the film industry and the very deceitful, murderous Susan Orlean is back with us.
Here I am in all my glory.
played by Meryl Streep, of course, in the film. Susan, it's great to have you back with us. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm very excited. You turned your attention to our own Los Angeles Central Library, which I thought I knew the history of, but you just have uncovered so much fascinating background to the library. How long have you been working on this book?
I've been working on it for almost 6 years, and it was not only that I'm a little bit slow, it's that it's got a vast history that is so interesting that I couldn't just cover up any aspect of it. It was all that interesting to me that I had to keep taking these little side trips down different aspects of the story of the library, culminating, of course, in the single biggest dramatic event in the library's history, which was the fire in 1986.
I coincidentally, on that day, had a meeting in what was then the first Interstate Bank Tower immediately across the street.
Oh,
I was
wow.
on one of the top floors. I was actually meeting with the mayor of Pasadena, who was the lead attorney on the merger that First Interstate was entering into with Bank of America at the time. So I happened to be in his office, and we were looking out his window, you know, from the top of the bed down on all the smoke coming out. And it was very difficult for me emotionally because I spent my boyhood going to that library. I knew it so well, the beautiful murals, all those volumes. And to see, you know, the extent of that damage, it was a very sad day.
I think it was devastating to both the people of Los Angeles, but especially for the librarians and the library staff who had spent their careers building up their collections, who felt a tremendous connection to their patrons, and they just watched it burn 7.5 hours, just burning out of control. None of them had any idea of what was going to happen next, whether the building would be destroyed, whether the library would ever reopen. It was a really devastating time.
And how many of the books could be saved? Because obviously the meticulous kind of, restoration process was huge as well. And you detail that the stress was so great on members of the library staff, that the marriages were lost, that it was just incredibly stressful for them.
The city ended up hiring a psychologist to meet with any librarian who felt the need for it. And there was a lot of real attention to the trauma that they felt. And part of it is their devotion to their job is it's more than just a job. They feel that it's a real mission, something that they put not just their mind into, but their hearts into. And suddenly they just didn't know what was going to happen next. So it was very traumatizing, and a lot of them asked to be transferred immediately. Some people left the profession. Most of all, though, they stayed with it in hopes that they would see the library open again.
We'll continue with Susan Orlean. We'll talk about the criminal investigation that followed the allegation that an arson fire is what had created this terrible destruction to the Los Angeles Central Library. And we'll talk about the coming together of Los Angeles for the restoration of the library, the big development project that came out of that to fund the restoration of the library. And then some little tidbits of information. For example, I didn't know that there was a list of questions that people have called into the library that they want to get answers, and some pretty funny ones over the years. We'll talk about that. Susan Orlean, the library book, her brand new book. She's here in Southern California for a couple of days. We'll continue our conversation right after a live update. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with the gifted writer Susan Orlean. Her new book, The Library Book, you read her in The New Yorker, and
her previous books like The Orchid Thief, her wonderful look at Rin Tin Tin, the movie dog. And she just finds all kinds of fascinating nuggets as a part of her research that she weaves into her very personal storytelling. That's what she did with the Los Angeles Central Library. Fascinating pieces of information I wasn't aware of, including, Susan, what a big role early Angeleno Charles Lummis played, a man who walked from Ohio, walked all the way to Los Angeles, who was a major journalistic figure early in this city's history. And I didn't realize he'd run the library.
He ran it for 5 years, starting with a bang, of course. He came in and triggered what became known as the Great Library War, because there was a woman running the library at the time, Mary Jones, who's very competent, very capable, had been running the library for quite some time when the board called her in and said, surely you agree with the idea that it would be better to have a man run the library. And she said no. And the library board persisted, and this was how Charles Lummis came to run the library. So he started in a rather dramatic fashion. He was not trained as a librarian, but he was incredibly influential. In the 5 years he ran the institution, he really transformed it from being a small town lending library. And L.A. was a small town in 1900.
Just over 10,000 residents or
and,
some?
Yes, and very unsophisticated and not a worldly city in any way. He had the idea that this should be a serious institution of learning, a reference library, one that had collections and didn't simply have books to borrow to read that would come and go. We've got a lot in the library now that he was instrumental in bringing, like all the California history. At the time he took over the library, nobody thought California history mattered. And it really seems so odd now when we consider it such a significant school of thought and study. Nobody considered the Southwest a region that was worth studying or collecting books about. So he began the entire collection of California history. He started the photography collection. He also had this idea that it would be really nice if the library had autographs from the leading thinkers and artists and intellectuals of the day. So he had some stationery made up for the autograph collection of the Los Angeles Public Library. He sent it to hundreds of prominent people and asked for their autograph and asked them to embellish the page in any way they chose, and got back this immense collection of autographs. And I really urge any of you who haven't seen that collection.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's amazing. He had, I mean, for instance, Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, signed an autograph and then illustrated the entire page. It's absolutely incredible. And this was Lummis's idea, that the library should have more than just books. It should be a center of knowledge, of learning, of the exchange of ideas. And we have him to thank, as much as he's an eccentric who had some distinct
very
flaws.
Sexist attitudes.
Very
yeah.
sexist. We have a lot to thank him for, and he really was a significant figure.
And I didn't realize that the extraordinary photo archives, that he was really the originator of that. I mean, many hard-working people have over the years built that.
But he started it. And at the time that he came up with this idea that the library should collect photographs, that was not a common idea. That was an unusual idea, and the LA Library has a phenomenal photography collection. We have him to thank for planting the seed of that, and it's grown
exponentially. It's an enormous collection.
Susan Orlean with us, the library book, her brand new book. If you have questions for her about the Los Angeles Library, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back to the devastating fire of 1986. How quickly was it identified as a likely arson fire?
From the beginning, there was some thought that it was arson. And within a few days, the LA Times published a piece saying arson was suspected. This was based on the idea that the fire had started on a bookshelf. So there's nothing in a bookshelf that would start a fire on its own. So you can't look at, say, an outlet at a wall, and if a fire starts near an outlet, you can imagine that there's a spark that started it. Instead, this was believed to have started on a bookshelf in the fiction department, near, coincidentally, the books of Ray Bradbury, who wrote Fahrenheit 451. But it immediately indicated to the arson investigators that this must have been deliberately set because there was nothing nearby.
Nothing else would explain
that would have started it. So it was investigated as arson almost from the very beginning and pursued as an arson fire through many twists and turns in the investigation.
And share with us a little bit of the background of the prime suspect in the case, because he's a fascinating figure.
In many ways, Harry Peek is another iconic Los Angelino. He was raised in Santa Fe Springs, east of the city. He was a big dreamer. He pictured himself having a larger life than what he thought was possible in Santa Fe Springs. He moved to LA to become an actor. He didn't have training as an actor, and I've come to realize I'm not sure he wanted to be an actor. I think he wanted to be a movie star, which is not the same thing.
Definitely not.
He auditioned to be an extra, to have small parts, but mostly he worked as a chauffeur. He worked in the parking garage at hotels around town. He was a big dreamer. He was a fabulist. He was a guy who couldn't tell you a straight story about his life. Everything was more dramatic and more exceptional than seemed possible. So at some point when he told friends that he had been at the fire, and then very quickly his story changed, and it was that he was not only at the fire, he had started the fire. Eventually, that confession, which was not told in a sort of sheepish way, but rather a kind of boast that he had been at the center of this dramatic event, that found its way to the arson investigators, who then zeroed in on him.
But when it came time, the DA looked over the case, they decided there wasn't enough there to file charges.
Well, this was a moment when the DA had lost some dramatic cases, and there was a real concern about pursuing a case that wasn't going to be a guaranteed win. In this instance, the evidence they had was largely circumstantial. It was based on a confession, which he then recanted. It was based on a number of librarians identifying someone who looked like him as having been in parts of the library he shouldn't have been in on the day of the fire. But there was no, oh my God, to use a pun, there was no smoking gun. Nothing that could absolutely guarantee that the city would win the case. So there was a real worry about pursuing it. And instead, the decision was made to pursue it in civil court, where the standard of proof is more generous than in criminal court.
I mean, important to mention that the fire burned so hot that any evidence that might have been there at the start of the conflagration would likely not have been there.
And that was a huge part of the problem. The fire rose to 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, so that anything near within the range of this fire was absolutely incinerated. You can imagine how hard it is to investigate a fire. And arson is the least successfully prosecuted felony of all felonies because of that very reason. Usually the evidence is non-existent once the fire has finished.
And at least now, you know, video cameras are fairly ubiquitous. But in 1986, you just didn't have anywhere near
nothing.
The number. You wouldn't necessarily catch the person on video.
Right. No video. And as we all know, one of the great virtues of a library is it's wide open. You can come in and you can come out and you don't sign in. You don't register. You're there. It's freedom for all of us to share and use. But it also means that there's no record of who came in and who came out in the course of a day.
We'll continue with Susan Orlean, the library book about the Los Angeles Central Library. Peter in Eagle Rock asks about the library workers who went back and wound up with respiratory illness. Yes, that's something that she shares with us. We'll find out about that. Susan Orlean joining us on Air Talk. We'll be back in 1 minute. Susan Orlean's new book, the library book, and she's going to be talking about it. She has an event coming up at the Los Angeles Public Library tomorrow night at 7:30. And then she'll be at the Buena Vista Branch Library of the Burbank Public Library System. That'll be on Thursday, November 1st. That event starts at 7 p.m. You don't have to write it down. You can just go to kpcc.org/airtalk, and you'll find our links to those two events that she has coming up. I mentioned Peter in Eagle Rock says that a number of the library workers went back to work and had respiratory illnesses as a result of their exposure. How serious a problem was that?
Well, this was a big concern because when you have fire gutting a building and opening up possibly to asbestos, and this building was built in the 1920s, it had asbestos in it, as would any building of that sort. A number of the librarians requested transfer to other branches. And I should say, librarians worked in the building for a short amount of time to help remove the books that were in there. And then the building was shut.
This was to see what could be saved, what was lost.
Exactly. So they didn't go back to work in the building beyond this period of time when they were removing everything. And for a while, there was no central branch of the Los Angeles Library, and then a temporary branch ended up opening on Spring Street. But it was then 7 years before the building reopened. And there were librarians who felt that they were exposed not only to asbestos, but just to the aftermath of a fire, which is all of the particulate matter from a fire and the dirt and grit that is created when you burn 400,000 books. So no matter what, it was not a very appealing workplace, and it was pretty tough for all of them to be in there helping clear the library out. And it added to their anxiety and stress, certainly.
You mentioned 400,000 books. Those were how many were destroyed, right? It was about a million volumes that suffered some degree of damage?
Yeah, there were 700,000 that were either burned or had water damage, and 400,000 that were just gone. They were just incinerated. And magazines, newspapers were all destroyed. So it was a huge loss. It was the largest library fire in the history of the United States.
And then a few months later, there was in the music section of the library another fire.
And that is almost more mysterious because the building was closed. There had been a security check in the room 5 minutes or so before this fire was reported. So it was very disconcerting. This feeling was that maybe it was someone on the staff who had access to the room who had started the fire. again, it was never solved, never understood what happened, who did it, why they did it. And fortunately, that was the end of it.
Now, it took 7 years, but the library came back, I think you could argue, even better than ever. The restoration of the beautiful historical features of the building. They didn't abandon the historic building. They were able to expand it as well with new features. And all of that was a rather innovative development project to come up with the funding for it.
Well, this was the interesting thing. The building itself was insured, but the contents were not. So we're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of books that had to be replaced. And the money needed to restore the collection itself was vast. And that was really the people of Los Angeles who contributed and created this fund that allowed the books to be replaced. But the expansion of the building was funded in a really interesting way, which we're now very accustomed to, and that is by the selling of the air rights over the library. The library was zoned to be much taller than, I mean, that piece of land had zoning rights to be much taller than the library was. And air rights were a new concept in financing at the time. So those air rights of the undeveloped airspace above the library were sold for many millions of dollars to developers who developed the buildings adjacent to the library that are among the tallest buildings in Los Angeles.
The U.S. Bank Tower, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a very novel way of both preserving the original profile of the building, but making use of its right to be a lot taller than it was. And it really kicked off a whole era of development in the city of Los Angeles once this air right deal was completed successfully. Suddenly it opened the opportunity for that kind of financing to be done elsewhere in the city.
And we got an extraordinary reopened Los Angeles library. Susan, we've spent almost the entire time talking about the LA library itself, but your book also spends considerable time, you know, about the science and art of the library and being a librarian. I want to give you a chance to close about the importance of libraries to us, because a lot more than just books, as important as they are.
Yes, and certainly the stewardship of books is an important mission for the library. But what I was really struck by and what I really love about the library is it's a created space to share stories, to share knowledge, to share information. And librarians are the gatekeepers in this rather special environment. There's nothing else like that in culture. It's inclusive. It welcomes every sort of person across the board. It allows people to explore any kind of information that they want, that they're curious about. That is such a marvelous thing we've created, and it fills me with real joy when I walk into a library and think about the people who make this place possible.
And what's so beautiful, Susan, is how libraries are as essential today, even in our internet age, as they were before we had the world at our fingertips. The Library Book, Susan Orlean, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.